The Global Jigsaw is the podcast lifting the language barrier to show you the world through its media.
Радіо Тегерану.
Ми не вторгались на територію України.
Western countries are not the international community. That era has finished.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Richard Kagoy, and on this edition of Focus on Africa, the island nation of Mauritius reached high-income country status back in 2020, but the rupee has taken a hit. We'll find out more about why the currency has depreciated. And we speak to the cast of Four Black Boys, which explores things that can be spoken about and the things that can't within black communities.
I remember me and my partner like being on the bus and let's say we're holding hands and another black man is coming up the stairs. And all of a sudden you kind of untether from one another, because to be seen as queer by another black man is to be really seen. And there's so much shame involved in that, because society has told you that, you know, there's an archetypical role or the way of being as a black man, and that doesn't encompass it.
It's Wednesday, the 27th of March. We're going to start today talking about Binance, the company itself, and the cryptocurrency exchange. Binance is recognized as the world's largest cryptocurrency exchange. Last month, Nigerian authorities clamped down on cryptocurrency firms over allegations that they were being used for money laundering and financing terrorism. Nigerian authorities also formally filed tax evasion charges against cryptocurrency firm Binance at the High Court in Abuja. The country's central bank alleged that over $26 billion worth of transactions had passed through the firm with untraceable sources. It accused the platform of fixing exchange rates and currency speculation, leading to the freefall of the Naira. It also ordered the firm to pay a fine of $10 billion. Two other platform's executives were arrested in Nigeria in February, but on Monday, authorities confirmed that one of them had escaped from custody. Officials said Nadim Anjawala, a British-Kenyan dual national, had fled the country with a smuggled passport, but a family source said he had left by lawful means. Nigeria is considered to be Africa's largest crypto economy. I've been speaking to my colleague Nkechi Ogbonna. So how popular is cryptocurrency in Nigeria?
Digital currencies are very popular in Nigeria and is mostly powered by young people. Now, this is because of the digital expansion that has happened in the country. Young people are powering the population. And so it's no surprise at all that the cryptocurrency market in Nigeria is quite huge. There are several cryptocurrency platforms that do exist in the country, but the most popular one is Binance, the global platform, because it operates in several countries across the globe, and it's being used for remittances, diaspora remittances. Those abroad use it to send money to those in Nigeria, and those in Nigeria also use it to, you know, buy plane tickets and do other sorts of transactions. It's also a means of savings as well. People use cryptocurrencies to save.
And what sort of market share does Binance have in Nigeria?
Binance refused to disclose exactly the number of people it has on its platform from Nigeria. And that's one of the things the authorities were demanding that the organization shares with them.
So maybe just to clarify this for me, because I'd like to understand really how the role basically that cryptocurrency plays in the Nigerian economy. Of course, you've talked about it being very popular among young people. So maybe you could just expand that a little bit.
So, Richard, the thing is, because of the weakness of the Naira, a lot of young people say, you know what, Richard, why would I save my money in the bank with very little interest rates on it? And then the value of the Naira is dwindling as the days go by. So why don't I put my money in cryptocurrency exchange, for instance, whereby depending on the market rates of the day, I can switch my Naira for cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin or whatever type of coin. And I know that the value is in Bitcoin, is not in my Naira bank account anymore, such that tomorrow, if the Naira continues to do a free fall, it doesn't impact my savings. And so it stems from, first off, people trying to protect their savings from being eroded by inflation in the country. Secondly, a lot of young people see cryptocurrency changing as an alternative source of income. Now, because of the economic crisis in the country, a lot of young people have said that it's difficult. Their monthly or weekly income is not sustainable anymore. And so they invest in cryptocurrency exchanges as a means of gaining extra incomes.
We've had an occasion to discuss about the state of the Nigerian economy on this podcast with you severally. One of the challenges is that, you know, the country has been battling rising cost of living. The naira has been depreciating for close to about 2 years, but of course there have been news about it appreciating. So bringing this together with food inflation, so do cryptocurrency sites really make the situation worse? Do they really aggravate the state of the economy?
Well, the government claims that some of these cryptocurrency platforms have been fixing the exchange rates, assuming the role of the central bank. And so this is stemmed from currency speculation, you know, where people just assume that the naira is weakening against the US dollar, for instance. And so rates have hiked on those platforms, and then it affects the general foreign exchange markets at the bureau de change operators and even in the banks as well. And so the currency was not stable for a very long time, especially after the central bank removed the multiple exchange rates regime that it has operated for a couple of years last June. The central bank decided that the market would determine what the exchange rate was. And so following that, the currency has been depreciating for quite a while. And this is owing to the surge in demand for foreign exchange. So the government claims that cryptocurrency platforms are partly responsible for that, although it has not presented any form of evidence to support this claim.
We've seen the government really making drastic decisions, including clamping down on cryptocurrency sites. So in your opinion, is that enough really to protect the local currency against further depreciation?
A few cryptocurrency exchange platforms, including Binance, were suspended almost 2 months now. Their sites have not been accessible by Nigerian users. And also some of these platforms have delisted the Nigerian naira from their platforms. And so the government said it was doing this to curb the weakening of the naira and currency speculations. But has that impacted a drastic gain in the exchange market? I am not sure that's totally responsible for it. We have seen the naira appreciate in the last couple of days, but this is probably owing to monetary policies and fiscal policies that the central bank has introduced, whereby the naira is now gaining and appreciating against currencies like the pound and the US dollar.
Binance, you know, the firm has really been in the news lately. There's so much focus on it, especially as a major player in the cryptocurrency market in Nigeria. So what's really been its contribution to the state of affairs in Nigeria's economy currently?
Binance has denied any wrongdoing in Nigeria's economy. And this started a few months back when the authorities said that the platform was, and other crypto platforms, I must emphasize, it speculated that they were being used to fund terrorism. It was also used for money laundering activities. And last month, the central bank revealed that over $26 billion worth of transactions were carried out on Binance platform. And these transactions were untraceable by the central bank. The users were not known, the receivers were not known, the destination was also not known. And so the authorities have said that these are some of the issues that Binance has basically disrupted the economic space. And so it singled out Binance because of its popularity and the amount of transactions that happen on the platform and the amount of users as well. Binance has not responded to these charges in any way, but the two foreign nationals who were held in one of the detention centers by the security agencies have been there. Binance has confirmed that one of them, the British Kenyan, has escaped. Nadim, who escaped, has been put on a red alert. Authorities say they have contacted Interpol to issue an international warrant for his arrest. So anywhere in any country he's found where Nigeria has extradition a treaty with, he would be repatriated to the country to face charges. But Richard, we should remember that this is not the first time that the Nigerian government is clamping down on cryptocurrency platforms. There was a 2022 ban on cryptocurrency trading completely in the country, and that ban was just lifted sometime last year in December, I think. And so here we are again, where the government has now finally banned Binance and other currency platforms owing to security issues and economic issues as well, as it has highlighted. And so we do not know what the impacts would be. But what we do know is a lot of Nigerian users have migrated to other smaller cryptocurrency exchange platforms that are not so popular, but are also very efficient, the ones that the Nigerian government is not clamping down against. And that's where they are currently trading at the moment.
The BBC's Nkechi Ogbonna. Have you ever been to Mauritius, the island nation which is in the Indian Ocean off the coast of East Africa? It's a beautiful island, popular with tourists from all over the world. And since independence from Britain in 1968, the country has developed into a middle-income country based largely on tourism. However, in the past few years, the Mauritian rupee has depreciated. Here's the view from Mauritians on the current state of the economy.
It puts a lot of uncertainty in everything that we do. It's like a hyperinflation imported from somewhere else, maybe. One of the favorite dishes in Mauritius is like a roti. And so we can just see it. Anybody who is conversant in any kind of mathematical notation would see the percentage at least is going up, you know. It's such a staple food that most people would think twice before buying.
It's getting more expensive, and we should say monthly, if not by the day. I've seen someone in the office who doesn't earn that much. They really struggle. They really struggle. Those whom I've met and talked, they really struggle.
I've been chatting to Manisha Dukoni, an economy strategist and investment expert in Mauritius. She began, of course, by describing the island to me.
We have beautiful rainbows, which is one of the things that whenever I've traveled and come back to Mauritius, I am always quite amazed. Lots of microclimates across the country because Mauritius is on a former volcano, which gives it that greenery, but also different scenery, very abrupt mountains at times. But Mauritius is not just the island of Mauritius. It's also the islands of Rodrigues, the island of Agalega, Saint-Brandon. Being surrounded by the sea is something that is very important for us. Being near the sea, being able to smell the breeze coming from the sea is part of our DNA in Mauritius.
That's a picture-perfect description of Mauritius. And I did know that there's, you know, multiple islands. But let's talk about its performance. The rupee hasn't been doing very well, so it's depreciated significantly over the past 5 or 6 years, you know, from the COVID pandemic. So break it down for me to understand, how's this depreciation really affected the economy?
I travel quite often because I'm an international consultant. And so very often I need to buy US dollars because I'm going in places where maybe my cards won't work. And it's always good to have some cash. In March 2019, going towards the pandemic, I could get a US dollar with about 34, 35 rupees, Mauritian rupees. Today, to get one US dollar, it costs me 46 rupees, if not more because of charges, etc. Just an analysis and looking at this, it really shows you how much the Mauritian rupee has lost in value. And it's a lot to do with the depreciation that happened in the wake of the pandemic. The economy closed, and when the economy closed, then we didn't have any foreign exchange coming from the tourism sector, which is one of the huge revenue generating sector of the country. That really gave a big hit on the Mauritian economy because the Mauritian economy is highly dependent on revenue coming from foreign sources.
I wonder how ordinary people and, you know, people who are in business have been now affected by this depreciation.
Well, if you are someone who is buying goods from outside, a lot of our goods come from two main sources, from China or from India. If a lot of those importers, whether you are an importer of metals, for example, from China, even if the cost of the metal hasn't increased, so let's say you're still buying something $100 and as you were pre-pandemic, that means now today when it reaches the Mauritian market, instead of 3,500, it is at 4,600 rupees, which increases the cost and makes it quite expensive for the local people, in particular when we're looking at some specific sectors which consume a lot. Same thing, let's say you are importing medicine from India and your medicine, say your medicine is just a dollar and it was a dollar pre-pandemic, it's still a dollar when you're buying it, but that means that you're now paying 46 rupees instead of 36 rupees. 10 rupees extra for your medicine is the increases in price. And it has hit not just the businesses, it has hit everyone across the country. It has hit all the consumers.
Okay, so the depreciation and what you're trying to explain to me translates to basically a steep rise in the cost of living for ordinary people in Mauritius, right?
For everyone, whether we're saying ordinary or less ordinary people, yes, the prices have gone up and that has led to a steep level of inflation. Last year, we had some of the highest level of inflation in the country. Now, thankfully, the level of inflation is going down. But level of inflation going down means that the prices are still going up, but it's not going up as much as it was last year.
Manisha, are there any indications of the rupee possibly gaining ground, maybe in the foreseeable future? Are we talking about a matter of months, or should we say a year? Or a couple, possibly, to see that the strength of the currency really improving?
I think many of the sectors that were hardly hit are now back on track. And the other thing that is good to know is the fact that there is foreign currency in the economy. A lot of it is in the financial services sector. Given many of the sectors are now picking up, the fact that the level of inflation is going down, at the end of the year, I think the Mauritian rupee is likely going to strengthen a bit more and maybe get back to a certain level, not the pre-pandemic level, but recoup a bit as we reach towards the end of the year. In particular also because at that time then some of the uncertainties that we have been going through internationally will ease, hopefully. But quite a bit of effort is being put in place to consolidate our economy and to build new sectors, whether it is the fintech sector or, for example, the biotech sector, we are already seeing in quite a promising way new investments coming into those sectors and new possibilities of products and services being brought into those sectors as well. These will definitely be revenue generating for the Mauritian economy.
Manisha Dukoni, an economy strategist and investment expert in Mauritius. When it comes to talking about mental health, particularly among men, especially those of African descent, this subject can often be a topic that's difficult to be open about. It's the stigma that's attached to it. Let me explain. Big boys don't cry and men don't shed tears is often the traditional and accepted gender norm in many African societies. In these patriarchal environments, men are under pressure to be emotionally strong and stoic, rarely showing their feelings, and that makes them prone to suppressing their emotions and not seeking the help they need at times of crisis or overwhelming events. It's a theme that writer and director Ran Kale Cameron was Black himself, wanted to tackle in his play in London called Four Black Boys Who Have Considered Suicide When the Hue Gets Too Heavy. The play received considerable acclaim in the UK and was nominated for an Olivier Award for Best New Play last year. It follows six young black men who met in a group therapy session where they discuss and argue about their numerous familial and societal problems they face, the things that they can talk about and the things that they can't talk about. I've been speaking to two cast members, Mohammed Mansari and Fela Lufadeju. Mohammed begins by telling me about the production.
For Black Boys is a play about six black men who are in therapy for multiple reasons. They each have their own personal reasons, and we see how all of these men, coming from their individual backgrounds and experiences, how they interact in the space, not knowing each other at first, listening to each other's lived experiences, and how that allows them to kind of unravel and be vulnerable in a space to talk about their self.
Talking about vulnerability and triggering a conversation that people generally are shy or don't regularly really have amongst themselves, especially as men. So, Fela, you know, the play addresses a very important subject matter. That's about mental health, something very, very complicated. Mm. How is that important to you personally?
Well, the whole subject is massively important to me, especially coming from a black African household, where I think I said to one of your colleagues when we last had an interview that my mom doesn't necessarily believe in it, and the mental well-being. And in this avenue, we get an opportunity to see the inner workings of the black masculine or the black mind and the black male mind. In a way, like I remember when I first saw the play drew out of me so much of the under crevices of my mind that maybe I might have uttered to myself in a dark moment, but it felt like it was pulled out of me and somebody was articulating it in a way that I could never myself.
Mohammed, you know, you play the character Obsidian, who's portrayed as headstrong, well-educated, mm-hmm. someone mm-hmm. who defies, you know, the typical stereotypes. You know, your character tackles how black history, specifically African history, is poorly told, especially within the UK curriculum. So how yes. significant is that to have your character highlight that in his monologue?
I think it's extremely important. I believe that when it comes to black history, a mentor of mine said to me, you need to understand where you're coming from to know where you are going to. Mm. And in this case, we're talking about our history and not just the history that has been prescribed to us or been, you know, told to us by the Anglo-Saxon curriculum. Mm. I think when you really understand your ancient sacred history, I'm from Sierra Leone myself, I think for me it emboldens me and strengthens me and gives me pride to understand that, one, there are certain spaces where in UK you can feel as though you're not welcome or you're not wanted as a black person. But when you know, okay, I'm smart, I'm intelligent, and my forefathers before me, they were also people that were innovators. They were people that led. You don't look for validation anymore. You walk with your chest and your head held high, and you stand in these spaces and own it.
Fela, I've grown up in Kenya. I've spent, you know, mm-hmm. The rest of my life in this continent. And so I know in terms of my socialization, we were not supposed to cry. We're not supposed to display anything that suggests, you know, vulnerability. And yeah. Looking at your character, you know, Jet, they tackle that taboo, and especially yes. when it comes to being open about issues that are related to health. So we see this when your father admits that he's been suffering from, you know, prostate cancer, but instead of seeking mm-hmm. help, he hid it and then, you know, would say he died with pride. How does that really yeah. reflect your dealings, especially with your parents and as a person of African descent?
Funnily enough, where it pertains to health, my parents, I've been fortunate enough that they've been quite open in the discussion, and they don't necessarily believe in the idea of pride. But I know many of friends and many of cousins and family members who are of that thinking. They do not necessarily want information about them to be out there. They believe in the mystique of keeping what is at home to themselves, because they don't necessarily want to look weak. I mean, we all somewhat care about images, but when it becomes at a cost to yourself, that's where the issue is.
You know, image is everything. And we're so very yeah. conscious, especially as men, in safeguarding that. And we just want to look at our best, you know, at any given time.
As we move on, you know, mental health wasn't struggles wasn't a topic when I was younger. I'm 33 years old. And I remember having that discussion with my mom when she was like, you don't want that mental health. And I was like, no, what do you mean by that? Like, it's about the discussion of opening and realizing that vulnerability is not weakness. Mm. Vulnerability is incredible strength. To be able to articulate your emotions and disarm people with your emotions, it's not, it doesn't show you as weak. It shows you as being really in tune and in touch with oneself.
Absolutely. And so, Mohammed, one of the things that your character sort of like expresses is the need to tackle the issue about colorism. Why do you think that's an important conversation that we should be having?
I was in the Philippines at the end of last year. I was working on a project and there were so many adverts for like skin lightening cream and yeah, just people trying to make their skin fairer, especially the women as well. And it kind of broke my heart because there was a day where I was on set, I was filming, and one of the runners she had a hood on, she had a scarf across her face. And I was like, it is so hot. Why are you wearing this? If we were in a desert, I would understand to protect yourself from breathing in the sand. But why are you wearing this? And she said, it's because I've got my skin lightening cream on. And if the sun hits my skin, then it won't be good for me. It then makes me think about how a lot of our mums, aunties, sisters, cousins are doing the same thing. And then you think, well, where did they learn that if your skin is lighter, you will be more desirable and it will up your value as a person? It's in proximity to whiteness, of course, because it's this whole European, Eurocentric, slim nose, light blue eyes, like we talk about it in the play, lighter skin. It's like, if in some countries, like those Scandinavian countries, if that's their standard of beauty, cool. Because, you know, we're not from there. But for us, we are black people. We are made to be in the sun. Our skin is melanated. When we even think about what is in melanin and how it helps your body, it's magic. This issue of colorism, I think it also comes down to the issue of self-love. That is what the play talks about, especially in the second act. It is essentially loving other people, loving ourselves and learning how to do that.
I'm wondering, fella, just opening up about the struggles of just being not a black man, but also queer. How do you think Jet would have engaged with this conversation around queerness in Africa? And it's a hot topic in this part of the world.
I think Jet somewhat pontificates with the idea of being queer, but doesn't necessarily like identify as being queer, especially in Africa. The queer subject, especially what's going on in Ghana now with this new bill, the criminalization of the LGBTQI plus community.
Mm.
I did a project in Nigeria not too long ago, a queer film, and just to be in and around, we had to have like security and convoys just in case we ran into some trouble. But specifically here in the UK for black men, it's queerness and sexuality, like Ryan wrote in the play, it's a dark theme in the sense that they don't necessarily identify as being queer. I remember me and my partner, my ex-partner, like being on the bus and let's say we're holding hands and another black man is coming up the stairs and all of a sudden you kind of untether from one another, because to be seen as queer by another black man is to be really seen, and there's so much shame involved in that. Yeah, because society has told you that, you know, there's an archetypical role or the way of being as a black man, and that doesn't encompass it.
Yeah, and just listening to the two of you, certainly the message, you know, hit home. And I think it's a fantastic piece of art. But really appreciate the conversation and, of course, even the time that both of you have taken just to engage with us here on Focus on Africa podcast. So, Mohammed and Fela, was great having you on the show.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to Mohammed Mansouri and Fela Lufadeju. That's it for this edition of Focus on Africa. This episode was produced by Patricia Whiten, Sunita Nahar, Daniel Dadzi, Yvette Togira Maria in London. Kani Sharp was in charge, and our technical producer was Winnie Simon. You can also check out our sister podcast, Africa Daily. It's a deep dive into one new story shaping the continent. I'm Richard Gagoi. We'll talk again next time.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast looking at the world through the lens of its media. In our second season, we unpick the narratives of the conflict in Sudan.
Concerns about the possibility of Sudan further fracturing.
The gang wars in Haiti.
Criminal gangs have basically taken over large swathes of the capital, Port-au-Prince.
The internal workings of Iran's influence operations.
The ultimate aim of these alliances, at least rhetorically for Iran, is to, in their terms, restore historic Palestine and destroy the State of Israel.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.